Hi, from what I understand, the desire for status is a very powerful evolutionary urge. It manifests itself in conscious ways, very obviously. I'm curious as to how it might unconsciously affect people's perception or expectations or career paths and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, we are a social species, and as a social species, I mean, part the one of the wonderful things, of course, is that we learn from each other. But another piece of it is that our position within that social environment has value to it, and so it influences the directions we take. Now, what's fascinating about humanity is our ability to define what constitutes status, a high status thing, differently in different information environments. So, you know, if you're a ram, you know, then your status depends on your ability to grow a really big horn and butt heads literally with another ram, right?
So he doesn't mean a Los Angeles ram. Right. He means...
Well, even Los Angeles rams do that, you know.
Okay.
They're butt head. No.
Yeah.
So, but they, you know, what happens is, right, I mean, evolutionarily, status is completely defined for them. And for us, we actually have this ability to redefine what constitutes status. And so one of those influences of your early childhood is you are taking in information from your parents and your peers and your teachers about what a high and low status thing is. And that ends up influencing directions you take. And so if you believe being a surgeon is a high status occupation, and being a music teacher is a lower status occupation, that influences the kind of direction you're going to take, not just explicitly. It's not that you're writing this down on a legal pad and saying, yeah, okay, status of the job, that's got to factor into this. It just influences what you gravitate towards and what things you're willing to tell people about your interests.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to add one thing, because it's a great question about just how we think about status. You know, I say this often on the show and in other circumstances as well. As a human brain evolved, the new stuff didn't replace the old stuff. It grew on top of it. So all of the very primitive things that make rams good rams, which what all males are doing is trying to get chicks. That's the deal. You know, that's how evolution works, right? And so if you think about it, you think about there are vestiges of things that we associate with status that no longer have any basis in the way they function in a contemporary society. I mean, if you look at leaders in organizations, male leaders, many of them are male, in especially in particular organizations, most of them are male, and they tend to be tall. Now, there's no advantage to being tall intellectually. But there are basic functions. Art's about a foot taller than I am, so that's why we'll have this argument later. But I'm telling you, there's no advantage to being tall. That we have things that evolved at a time when those differences matter, right? And now we're in a society where there's a whole different set of variables that lead to whatever a successful outcome happens to be. I mean, not just, you know, getting mates, but getting prestige or getting fortunes or whatever that happens to be. But the thing to think about this, I think, is an interesting thing to, in response to your question, is how much of that is operating below our conscious awareness, right? And it's not something that we just sort of think our way out of. I mean, that's there. It you can't just will it away. It's recognizing is good because it helps you deal with it in a more effective
way. And actually, I got to add one more thing to this, which is one of the places, and yes, being taller helps. but that was what I wanted to say. No, it's one of the ways where this can actually get in the way is if you look at course evaluations in college. So because college students are consumers, they are given a tremendous amount of power over the evaluation of classes. And at the end of the semester, students get a little evaluation form and they fill it out. How much did you like this professor? How much did you think you learned from this? And all that. And that ends up influencing promotion decisions and all kinds of other stuff. So getting good rankings is important. Well, what predicts good rankings? Among other things, how attractive you are, how fluent a speaker of the language you are, as well as your command of the material, all of that actually has a positive influence on your evaluations. And how much work you had to put in, whether the class frustrated you at times because you had to work hard to understand the material, that actually has a somewhat negative influence on evaluations. Unfortunately, if you do the analyses, how attractive the professor is has very little influence one way or the other on how much you learn from the class. But actually how, you know, a small amount of frustration, which lowers course evaluations, actually increases learning. And so some of these status factors end up having either a neutral or even somewhat negative influence on how much students are learning in classes. And some of these other factors that are actually really important for learning are being beaten out of professors because of the nature of the evaluation. So actually this status stuff, because of the way it evolved, could sometimes actually have really negative influences.
We're gonna do a show on that question right there. I think we need to do it. I know. Next question? Yeah. Or whoever's got the mic.
Thank you. First off, Art, Bob, thank you very much. I love your show. I look forward to it every week. It's meant a lot to me over the last several years. I mean that very deeply. One of the things that you've mentioned a couple times is the aspect of privilege. And we now are becoming more obvious, our society, there are many people who are not in privilege. And for those of us that are working with many of them, and we think about this great book, Brain Briefs, are there certain areas that you would point to that we're able to help with those that aren't grown up in privilege?
Well, let me just start by saying that, you know, the combinations of factors that influence our lives, whether it's our genetic predisposition or the fact that we made very good decisions in choosing our parents, you know, whatever those things happen to be, you know, make it easier or harder for us to do things. I mean, I think one of the things that I try to impress upon students who come to university is that, you know, everybody can come in the room the same. I mean, some people know a lot more stuff than other people. Some people's processing speed is faster than other people. And, you know, the way of having people come to accept individual differences is not to pretend they don't exist, but to acknowledge them and not have a problem with it. This has to do with people who come from different backgrounds. It has to do with people who come with particular abilities or disabilities. But one of the things I think is important is that, you know, we say things to people that are lovely in terms of their aspirational nature, but they're just not true. You know, if you're 4'3", you're probably not going to get an NBA contract. And to say, you know, you can if you really want it hard enough is not a kindness, right? But I think, you know, when you think about what it means to be successful in life, there are many people in the world who do lots of different things, and they feel very proud and very much like they're contributing to what they do. And Art taught me this story, but I'm not going to let him tell it. That when John F. Kennedy had challenged the country to get to the moon by the end of the decade of the 60s, and he visited what was then Cape Canaveral, and he passed down a hallway, and there was a custodian who was cleaning the floor. And Kennedy said, "And what are you doing here?" He said, "I'm sending a man to the moon." Now, anything is a custodian, but you know somebody's got to do that, right? And that's a very honorable job. And I think what we often do, especially in a society that's very quick to establish pecking orders, you know, and often based on wealth, is not to acknowledge the dignity in all of the things that human beings do. And I think when people come from a background that doesn't particularly have privilege, it didn't provide them the kinds of opportunities that those of us who were much more fortunate were provided, you know, there are things that make life very gratifying. And granted, it's harder to be gratified when you're doing a job where you have a boss who tells you everything you're supposed to do, and it's kind of not very satisfying thing. But I think all people have a potential to see good in what they do, in a way that I think is inspiring. I mean, not just for other people, but for themselves.
And if we look at the book itself, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things we tried to do with this book is to really say, okay, here are a number of things, some of which are frivolous, like, you know, are cat videos good for you? But a lot of them really get at issues like what makes us happy. And you know, what is the value of being open to new things, and what does it mean to be more or less conscientious? That you may not bump into in your daily conversation, right? And yet, I mean, my belief, one of the reasons that I do these kinds of things, you know, one of the reasons why I leapt at the chance to do a radio show, in addition to the fact that we got to spend time together, was I believe that the more people know about their minds, the better their life gets, right? Because everyone's got a mind, and we spend precious little time teaching people how it works. And even understanding why a couple of kitten videos are actually kind of good for you is actually a benefit, right? I mean, it you know, and so you know, I think that one of the things we need to be doing is letting everybody know a little bit more about the way they think and about the way they act. Because, for example, if you think about happiness as one simple example, and we've talked about this on the show before, accomplishment doesn't make you happy. It's not about achieving a thing. You know, we are lucky enough to have written a book. Writing that book and completing it and having this object did not make either of us happy, or if it did, it's going to be fleeting. It was the fact that we got to do something fun. We enjoyed the process of writing it. We enjoyed the process of working together. We knew that we were still going to be able to get back in the studio and hang out. Those experiences are amazing. And it is experiences that influence your happiness far more than these kinds of achievements. But people spend their time thinking, if I could just have done that thing, that would have been the thing that made me happy. And that's never true. And so, you know, to me, no matter what background you come from, if you can be excited to get out of bed because of something that exciting and fun that you're going to get to do that day, that's going to help you to lead a happy life. And if somebody convinces you you're not going to be happy unless you own this thing or get this job, they can diminish your happiness in ways that because they are getting you to focus on something that is absolutely untrue.
Okay, guys, so your book is Brain Briefs. Sounds like a men's underwear commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Wait. So we have a whole story about the title.
Just a minute. Let me ask a question.
Okay.
Just a minute.
Okay.
So, that's a good story. So, given your conversation about the iteration of editing and iteration of how, what was the original? About the iteration of the title.
So, okay. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
We couldn't have paid
for it. So, okay. So, in the proposal for the book, the book was called Bite Size Brain, which we thought was kind of good. But our publisher, who has great taste, really, because it's got an orange cover, said, Bite Size Brain sounds like very small brains, and who would want to eat a brain anyhow? And so we're not going to do that. And so they countered with brain query, a made up word, brain query.
And brain query.
And Bob and I went,
Well, no, we didn't only go, So they sent us a mock up of the title page, and it said brain query. You get the idea? Okay. And except whoever had set up the text had the first three letters in a different color than the rest of the word. So it looked like bra inquiry.
Which did seem like a better book.
Okay, let's go with that.
Okay. So then they actually said, we said, no way. And we suggested all kinds of other titles, and they just didn't listen. They actually sent Brain Query with that cover, but it said Brain Query on it, to Amazon back in May. And we called them and we said, we have to have a conversation about this. So we thought we're having this conversation in order to in order to brainstorm about new titles. And they thought they were having a conversation to convince us that Brain Query was a great title. And so we had this conversation, and afterwards we wrote another chapter for the book on what makes a good title for a book. And used Brain Query as the example of the lousy title.
Yeah. Now we meant it with love. It was meant with all.
And then we finally, to shorten the story a little, we finally had one additional conversation in which our editor and her boss got on the phone, and they said, our plan for this conversation was to spend one more conversation trying to convince you to go with this title, but beforehand we were going to take out the big guns. So the editor's boss said, so I went to the president of the company and I said, we have these authors who don't want to use the title that we've already spent all this time and effort on, and we need your backing on this. And the president said, well, what's the title? And the editor said, well, it's Brain Query. And the president said, but that's a terrible title. Change it. And so then we had and then we went back and forth.
Yeah. And so Brain Breeze was a compromise. It wouldn't be our first choice, but you know, you're working with people, everybody's gonna
So there you go.
Anyway, that's the story.
As opposed to bra, you want to breathe.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Went to bra.
Different book.
Somehow underwear survived. Yeah.
Oh, next question.
Hi. I wanted to ask a little more about your process. I love believing that Chloe sets all your subjects. But do you come in with ideas? Do you research things and bring them back the next week? Sort of, how does it go?
Well, there are a number of sources, actually. You know, when we first started and we didn't know what we were doing, and now we're very experienced, so we don't know what we're doing. But when we first started, we actually made a Google Doc somewhere and we wrote stuff down and thought about it. But actually, I have some habits. I get up in the morning and I read several newspapers in the morning. That's just my routine in the morning. So I see an interesting article and I just shoot it to Art and Rebecca. No commentary. I just say, look at this. And so Rebecca writes some of those things down. Also, people now, because our Twitter feed and our Facebook page is now followed by some people, people will send in a question from time to time. Sometimes Chloe does something and we have to talk about that. So there are various things. And, you know, there are things in the news that sort of come up. I mean, we did a thing on plagiarism.
Just came out of thin air.
It came out of thin air.
Right. It was like the Tuesday after the Republican National Convention started, as I recall. I don't remember what the inspiration for that was.
I don't either. So it's pretty random, actually. And, you know, the thing that's sort of fun for me in this is that Art's a really smart guy. He knows a lot of stuff. And so when we talk together, he brings up things that I'd never thought about. And then I sort of respond to that. And I think the reverse is also true. And, you know, Rebecca, what Rebecca brings to the table is she is a joyfully curious person. And, you know, we're both teachers. We love information. We love knowledge. We love understanding how the world works. And to be in the presence of someone who is so joyfully curious, is think, well, what's that about? You know, and I mean, it's not just bullshit. I mean, she really wants to know that. And sometimes we know the answers to that. We have no idea. We still say stuff. But the thing that's interesting about that is that how much being in an environment where people who like each other, and I think that comes across in the show, that we're very fond of each other, and I think, you know, like the Card Talk guys, who we are very flattered to be compared to from time to time, you know, I think all of us like to hear people having a good time, and I think, you know, one of the things that our relationship that has evolved over the years has done is sort of helped all of us sort of help each other come up with things that people might find interesting.
And the one other thing I want to add to this that I think has been a lot of fun is that we will sometimes start with a topic, and then after a couple of minutes of conversation, that topic actually morphs into something else that's actually way more interesting than the thing we thought we were going to be talking about. And then the show actually becomes about that. And one of the nice things about having this kind of time and space to talk for half an hour, 45 minutes about a topic is that it gives us a chance to figure out what we really meant to say. You know, and I think there's a lot of, you know, one of the other things that's happened is Bob and I have had a chance to witness other podcasts, you know, for example, in the promotion of this book. And a lot of people who do these podcasts, they just like their show's going to be 30 minutes and they just they let a tape roll for 30 minutes and then that's their podcast. And then and that misses out on this opportunity to really explore a topic, figure out what it's really about. And a lot of times, I mean, one of the great things that Rebecca's done is to get these really pithy statements of what we're getting at that are at the front end of the show. And a lot of times we don't end up saying that thing until halfway through, or sometimes at the very end, you know, we'll be like, what was that about? Oh, here's a sentence about what this was about that encapsulates the core idea. And I think the ability to do the show in that way, rather than just assuming that you can roll tape and that's going to somehow create greatness, is really important. Well, it doesn't for us.
Yeah, and I mean, from a producer's perspective, and thank you for that question, Patty, it's like a lot of times, as a producer going into something, you go in thinking you're supposed to have a roadmap for things because that'll make you seem like you know what you're doing. And I actually don't think that's how magic happens. You know, I'm a huge fan of like live shows and the way that things kind of unravel and happen, and you trust that things are going to go from one area to the next, and you can kind of trust that. And if you try to make that happen too much, my experience as a producer, and I've been in radio for 20 years, you know, producing all kinds
of
crazy shows. I love you. This is one reason why we get along. Constant compliments. But it like creates this sense that, like, you know what you're doing because you have a roadmap. And I actually don't think that that's the value of maps at all. I think like the value of maps is like giving you a sense of place. But I don't think that's really how things ever evolve or happen. And for us, it's been really fun to just kind of like figure it out, you know, along the way. And so... anyway, yeah. It might be hard to create a budget around that, but it's fun. Go ahead.
Hi, my next question comes from the world of parenting psychology. I wanted to find out your perspective on the act of a parent letting their child fail. And I have an 11-year-old, and I'm very willing in so many ways to see her become an independent young woman. But there's something about seeing the train wreck of failure play out that really just is so hard for me to not intervene on.
Well, you're certainly not alone in that as a parent, right? I mean, that's parting and being a parent is making sure that your children are happy and fulfilled and rewarded. And my wife used to say, you know, if things were working perfectly, our daughter would live with us until she was 45. And then we'd make all our decisions for her and make sure everything worked out great. That isn't the way it works out. But, you know, one of the things that I think we often mistakenly feel is that the momentary disappointments and thrills that people have greater lasting effects than they really have. I mean, all the people who are the happiest in life, by whatever measure we assess that, aren't happy because only good things happen to them. They're happy because they understand that things go up and down, and sometimes things are a little not happy, and sometimes they're a little really happy, and every once in a while they're like really happy, and it's like a really terrible. But what happens in that sort of oscillation is the long-term recognition that stuff changes, right? I mean, I think what all of us would want for our children as parents is to have it not change, to have it always be lovely and wonderful. But, you know, a metaphor that I started using a couple of years ago in talking about learning experiences, and I often talk about this in an academic context, but I think it's true in a social context as well, is the reason we put training wheels on bicycles, right? A lot of parenting is set up the way some parents mistakenly set up training wheels on bicycles. And what I mean by that is, all three wheels, the main rear wheel and the training wheels, are all touching the ground at the same time. So no matter what the child does on the bicycle versus like throwing herself to one side, the bicycle is going to remain perfectly upright. Now, no child is going to learn anything about riding a bicycle from that, right? They'll learn about pedaling and steering. They'll learn nothing about balancing on a bicycle. So how should training wheels be set up? each training wheel should be a couple inches off the ground, right? So now, as the center of gravity shifts from left to right a little bit, there are errors that take place, right? So I've sort of fallen this way a little bit, but I'm making errors, but I can't make a catastrophic error because the training wheel is going to keep me from falling completely over and hurting myself, right? All the learning experiences that I plan in my classes and that Art plans in his classes, I try to structure that, right? I try to structure lots of room for mistake making. And but by the way, I often use the term mistake making rather than failure. Failure sounds so absolute, isn't it? You know, I've failed at my job, I failed at my marriage, like, you know, the whole thing's dead, you know. But I think what's different about that when you start talking about terms of mistake making, first of all, it lowers the heat a little bit. And it acknowledges the fact that, of course, the bicycle is going to tip this way and that way a little bit. And you'll learn from that. And what you'll learn from that will make you better able to navigate whatever things come in the future that you might not be able to anticipate.
And the other thing there's two other things to add to this, because I love that metaphor. One is that pain is also something we learn from. And so, you know, pain is no fun, and I don't recommend, you know, having to do that all the time. But there are but recognizing when you've done something bad that was painful, and learning how not to have that happen again is a powerful thing that you often have to experience yourself. I actually remember my parents. I had a big report. I mean, as big a report as you can have in third grade that I had to finish. But it was like, you know, it was like a 3-week thing that we had to do. And I didn't do it, and I didn't do it, and I didn't do it. And my parents didn't do a thing. And on the night before it was due, I was like, I had stuff all over my room, and I was going crazy, and I got like 2/3 of it done, and it was horrible, and I felt lousy. And I don't think I even did particularly well on it. But I remember afterwards my dad sitting down and saying, so how did that feel? I was like, yeah, not so good. And honestly, ever since, I started working on stuff ahead of time because I hated that feeling so much. And it was an extraordinarily valuable experience to have learned from that kind of bad experience. So that's one piece. And then the other piece that's related to that is those bad experiences are going to happen. Sometimes the best of intentions go badly and you have a bad experience, and sometimes you blow it and things go badly, and you have to learn that that's not the end of the world, that tomorrow's another day, and you learn from that and you move on. And you know, the fewer experiences you have at those painful experiences, the less experience you have recovering from bad things that happen. And they're going to happen eventually. So they may as well happen when the stakes are low rather than when the stakes are high.
And just one quick thing to add to that, because I think it's a really important question that you ask. I think where most hurt comes from when something doesn't go the way we want it to go is having no recourse, having nothing that we can do. You know, we're so helpless. And little kids are like this. They tantrum. They lay on the floor and they kick their feet and that's it. And we say, well, that's a little kid, you know. Yeah, right. But what we can teach as parents, right, is, okay, so now what are you going to do? I mean, this thing happened. It's terrible. You're crying. You're upset. So what are you going to do? Because one of the things that we fail to recognize as human beings, right, is that through millennia of evolutionary history, our bodies are why our minds are doing what they're doing, right? I mean, our minds are there to help us move effectively. And what our minds are really bad at is doing nothing, right? What our minds are really bad at is sitting and feeling bad. And almost every therapist, if you go to a therapist and you're really distressed and you're really distraught, what a good therapist is going to do is give you homework with things to do. Right? Not to think about, but to actually do. And I think all parents who are successful at developing resilience in their children create that for their children, right? I know you feel terrible now and you're upset and you want to cry. Okay, let's take a few minutes and do that and be really miserable. And now let's think about what we're going to do now. Because all people who have whatever people describe as resilience, that's the thing. It's not that bad things don't happen to them, you know? And many people who are not resilient and see generally happy people mistakenly think, well, nothing bad ever happens to you. You know, you're just, life's just a bowl of cherries, and so of course you're happy. Actually, that's not true at all. I mean, if you look at all the indicators of happiness that psychologists have studied for many decades, right? The people who are the happiest are not the people who have, you know, life's just going great. It's the way they respond to the things that they confront. So what is Art saying, right? Every opportunity that there is for something unhappy to be now in your face as a child or a young adult or even as an adult is an opportunity to practice actually doing something that focuses your attention away from whatever miserable thing you're doing at the moment.
Really great stuff, guys. I always love hearing what you do. In the radio advertisement, there is a mention of a question regarding why time seems to slow down as you age.
Speed up.
Speed up. That's what I meant. Thank you. Thank you. That, the opposite.
You're right.
If only it slowed down.
You seem like a very young person. That's why you said that.
Young, maybe in physical appearance. But I'd love to hear the answer to that, as I'm just starting in my own life to feel the repercussions of time speeding up exponentially.
Yeah. Yeah, sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things that are going on with the sense of time and speeding up, the feeling that it's speeding up. One of which is, if you think about how you remember stuff that happened to you in your past and how long you believe it took, a lot of the length of time is related to how many landmarks you could, distinct landmarks you can remember about something. And so the more distinct landmarks you have in memory, the longer you feel that something took. And of course, as you get older, there are fewer new things that happen, particularly if you kind of get into a routine with a job or with a place that you're living. Then, you know, if you're coming back to the same house year after year, if you're celebrating holidays with the same group of family, if you are, going to the same work location, then there are fewer and fewer distinct landmarks. And now when you look back over a period of time, it all seems to mash together. Whereas if there were lots of distinct landmarks, now the sense of how much time has passed actually seems to get longer. So that's one piece of it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this, we have to say, is conjecture, because we really don't know for certain why this is. So we're making some conjecture.
There are studies on this.
Yeah, there are. And the other thing about this too, though, is that if you think about the proportion of our lives that a year is when we're 60 compared to what proportion of our life is a year is when we're 2, there's a lot more of our life that goes by in a year between the ages of 2 and 3. There's a lot less that goes by in the ages of 61 and 62. And so, as Art's saying, the things that we do regularly, the things that we do repeatedly, and the fact that we're old, we've had a lot of experiences, right? Is that, well, yeah, I've seen that before. And what brains do really effectively is habituate, which means they don't pay attention to things that don't change. So if we're doing things that are very repetitive and very much the same from one year to the other, we tend just not to pay attention to them. So it seems like time is just whizzing by.
And the reason for that is this other thing that we've talked about a lot on the show, which is a fundamental function of the brain is to predict what's going to happen next. And if your life is, yep, seen that, oh, seen that, seen that, then your brain doesn't really have to work that hard. It's doing its job just on the basis of everything you've already experienced. So one of the real values of doing lots of new and interesting things, like, say, I don't know, starting a radio show and then writing a book, is that it now your brain doesn't predict as well, because now suddenly, you know, you're in a radio studio and you have no idea where to put the mic. Still, after all, David
That's
Alvarez will
me,
tell you.
Actually. No one else. And so
engaging in all these new experiences provides all these opportunities for your brain to say, okay, I have no idea what's going to happen now. I'd better pay attention. And that actually does slow down both your sense of time in the moment as well as your retrospective sense of how long that period of time was.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. One more question.
Hi, I'm a social and organizational psychologist and a little bit of a law background, so dabbling in forensics. So that gives me my filter on what I like to talk about and get expert in and what I want to dabble in. So I'm sensing that you are both in cognitive or a touch of neuroscience or something, and I'm hearing things on learning and memory. And so I'm wondering, I'm trying to figure out what makes you tick.
So is my wife.
So are you dabbling?
Impact as a verb.
So for, are your topics for your book and your shows, because of you're coming at it from as an expert in areas and that you want to tackle, do you see life experiences that you think you have something to say? What narrows your focus on what goes into what you guys discuss?
You know, it's interesting to ask that question. You know, I think one of the things that we can say about working in an institution like UT is that even though there's a tremendous amount of compartmentalization from one department to another, that is becoming increasingly less the case. I don't know if you're an Edward O. Wilson fan, but he wrote a great book called Consilience. And basically the whole theme of the book is that the barriers that he contends are artificial between disciplines are coming down and things are more similar and more connected than we first imagined them to be. And I think Art and I think like that. I think, you know, Art is one of the most prominent cognitive scientists in the world. I teach in the music school. I teach in a department called Music and Human Learning, and I study the way people develop memories for skills and those kinds of things. But I think both Art and I are broadly curious, and one of the things that I think made us feel connected to each other, even before, years before we ever did A Views and Brews and all that kind of stuff, is we sort of look for things that are related to other things, even things that seem very distant related, you know? And I think that's what many people find interesting to listen to us about, is because we sort of bring things together that seem like, well, how did that get there, you know? And that's kind of the way we think. It didn't come out, we didn't plan that, but I think that's, for whatever reason in our backgrounds, that's the way we ended up thinking, and we sort of found each other, and here we are.
Yeah, and I think that I mean, I grew up almost as a native cognitive scientist, meaning that I my undergraduate degree is in cognitive science, which means I actually took very little psychology. It was mostly computer science and philosophy and a little bit of neuroscience and other things. And I now run a program at UT called the Human Dimensions of Organizations, which looks at the way people function in workplaces using the humanities and the social sciences and the behavioral sciences. And I'm teaching a class now in which I've given some lectures on history. So, you know, I think one of the, and this gets to something that Rebecca said we had to talk about in the show, which is I've always felt that cognitive science was the field where Nobel laureates come to die. Because there is no Nobel Prize in psychology. Occasionally psychologists win it for economics, like Danny Kahneman, or physiology if they're neuroscientists. But generally what happens is you'll get like a physicist who looks over at psychology and goes, that's easy, I'm going to go over there and figure that out, and then they're never heard from again. because people and brains and social interactions are way more complicated than anything that physicists and chemists are studying. And those of you listening out there, bring it on, okay? But what that means is that we have to draw our insight into humanity and the human condition and the way minds and brains work from everywhere. Right, which means not just sciences like neuroscience and psychology and areas like computation and philosophy, but also history and literature and the study of languages. And Bob's in a music school, and what that says is, you know, he feels the same way. And so one of the real joys of doing this show is there's no real boundary. And so, you know, and Rebecca, who loves to read widely on all kinds of topics, will come in sometimes with some poetry or something that she's been working on for another show, and that will influence the direction we go in. Because in some ways, I think it's all fair game for trying to get some insight into what the human condition is like, even though at the end of the day, we still want to come back to the psychology literature and present things in a way that also comports with what we know from the studies that have been done.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you say that too, because I was just listening to something where they were quoting Tristram Shandy, this quote, to define is to distrust. And what they were talking about around that, which is the idea that once you have a definition for a relationship, it's kind of done and set aside. And once you have a definition for yourself, you no longer have a relationship with yourself. You know, so I think like the thing about two guys in your head and this book and this whole project is like, we have no idea what it is actually. And so, which is a good thing because we constantly have an ongoing relationship trying to figure out what we're doing.
Right, and it also means whatever we do next can't not be part of what we
exactly.
are. which actually, by the way, matters a lot. I think a lot of us edit things out of our lives because we think, well, that's just not me. I wouldn't do that, right? And I think it's actually really important to say, well, particularly intellectually, why should I limit myself to the stuff that I think is relevant to the problems I'm studying?
Great, thank you so much. And I hope it's a good one. I didn't realize I'd be last, but you referenced earlier sort of how you could have two kids, same house, same dinner table, completely different, right? I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference or the distinction, I guess, between objective human evolution, the things that we all share, and the subjective human experiences, things that are particular to a person, and how that relates to who ultimately we are and why we have a multitude of differences, even in similar settings.
So I'm going to start by saying that our genetic endowment as humans is amazing, and there are certain things like personality characteristics and certain elements of sexual attraction that have strong heritable components. But I want to focus for a moment on the value of experience. Right, and the story that I always tell about this, which I think is really important to understand, is so I years ago, living in Northwest Hills in Austin, had a baby deer born on the front yard, and within 24 hours it had stood up and bounded off with its mom, and within a year it was a fine, upstanding member of the deer community. And I have three kids, and two of them are in their early 20s, and they're only just barely taking their place in society now. So why are deer members of their community in a year or two, and it takes two decades for kids to reach the same place? And the answer is deer are stupid. They come programmed by evolution with a fairly small number of behaviors that are extraordinarily well adapted to a forest environment with particular kinds of predators.
Like Westlake Hills.
Right. Yeah. And particularly bad at Austin. Okay? They can't cross the street. They haven't figured out HEB yet. And our kids and all of us managed to adapt to an information landscape that our evolutionary forebears could not possibly have imagined. And that's because a lot of our evolutionary mechanisms make us very sensitive to the information that is provided to us by other members of our species, by parents and teachers and friends. And we learn to navigate the information landscape as it is right now at the cost of it requiring a decade and a half to two decades to get there. And I think what's important to recognize is that even though there are some profound elements that our evolutionary endowment creates for us, what evolution did for humans and really for no other species was to allow us to really drink in the information that's around us from all of these other people and to learn from them. And the unfortunate thing for most of us is we do that deeply for the first two decades of our lives. And then after that, many people go, okay, I'm done, right? And they go on and live the rest of their life with whatever knowledge they picked up to that point. And so in many ways, to me, the lesson of what we've got is that we actually have to keep drinking from the information that's available to us from all of the people around us for our entire lives and not just for the first couple of decades.
And that too, like we were talking about earlier, is easier for some people in some circumstances than others, right? But regardless of one's circumstances, right, there are opportunities where you have a chance to experience something new. And I think what the advantage we give to children, when we teach them that they don't really want to go up and introduce themselves to that new person. They don't want to say hi. They want to hug mommy's leg or whatever, to say, no, I want you to go meet that person, right? Those small things that we teach that are really strategies for engaging with people and situations about which we may initially feel uncomfortable, that is a great gift to give to a child, right? I mean, to get out of the idea that, you know, I'm really not sure about this. Okay, well, just go try that out, you know? And I think that, as Art's saying, that level of experiential learning is something that is in many ways unique to humans, right? Because think about it right now. We have computers in our pockets that are connected to even larger computers that are connected to God knows what, and probably they know what you had for dinner. You know, I mean, there's all that kind of stuff going on, and yet, right, it's possible to go through a life experience and not avail yourself of all these other things that are available to you. And I think regardless of what social circumstances you find yourselves in or what kinds of circumstances we're raising children in, that prompting, that initiative to go and do something that you might not feel like, this might not feel good right away, but just try that a little bit. And, you know, all of us who had parents who said, you know, I know you don't like the peas, you don't like the way they look, just eat a fork full of peas. And even if you say, okay, after that, I don't like the peas, I don't want any more peas, okay, that's fine, but you got to taste the peas. And, you know, how'd I get to that? But anyway, you got to taste the peas. And I think for many of our children, you know, you go to a place and there's a party, there's a sleepover, I don't want to go, just taste the peas. That's going to be a shirt.
Just taste a world peace. So, and by the way, because I am in charge in this show of shameless promotion, Bob said the greatest gift you can give to a child, and I just wanted to extend that and say...
is the book. It's reading.
I just had to do it. The greatest kid. No, but we do appreciate you coming out tonight. And so thanks for helping us to celebrate. It's so cool to have a thing.
It is so,
you know,
cool,
I have to tell you,
thing.
And just an update, because I've been getting signals on my phone about what's going on in the vice presidential debate, and I have it on good authority. Mike Pence said a lot of bad things about Hillary Clinton, and Tim Kaine said a lot of bad things about Donald Trump. Just so you're up to speed on what was going on.
Hope it's not a spoiler. But, you know, I mean, it's funny because we started off with biography. And when I grew up, I'm the child of two immigrants. And I grew up in a farming community, you know. Basically, I was supposed to farm because I started at 12 detasseling corn. But a friend of mine said to me when I was very young, the greatest thing about the mind is one's ability to change it. And that has stuck with me my entire life. And I think it's really interesting to understand that we always have the ability to change and to change our minds and to read this book and to change how you perhaps look at the world.
What a
Who
great
knows?
Place to stop.
But, you know, thank you guys so much. Thank you not only for this doing the show, but thanks for coming out.
Thanks.
Thanks for the
thanks,
book.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks so much. Thanks
thank
for coming out.
Thank you so much for coming out this evening. Check out the podcast, buy the book, and continue to support Two Guys on Your Head.
Thanks
awesome.
So much.
Thank you.
And tip your bartender.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll sit over here and sign some books for you.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store, or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.